Hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States in this honorable court.
Good morning and welcome to the 11th Circuit. Judge Jill Pryor and I are very pleased to have with us today helping us Judge Roy Altman of the Southern District of Florida. We really appreciate his time and his effort, and we're thrilled to have him sitting with us today. I think you're all familiar with our timing system, but just a quick review. The time that you have available will be posted up on the screen. If it's green, you're good to go. If it's yellow, you're running out of time. If it's red, you're over your time. We ask that you please stay within your time unless we ask you questions that take you over. If we do ask you questions that take you over, then of course, please answer them. We're asking the questions because we need to know the answers. All righty. With that, we will begin with Goggins versus Secretary of the Department of Corrections, case number 20-11033. We will begin with Professor Morley. Professor Morley, oh, you've got it. Okay.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michael Morley, and I represent the appellant Marcus Goggins. This case is an appeal from the district court's denial of Mr. Goggins' petition for relief under 28 U.S.C. 2254 without an evidentiary hearing. This court granted a certificate of appealability on two issues. First, whether reasonable jurists would find debatable or wrong the district court's conclusion that Goggins' claims 2 and 3 for ineffective assistance of counsel were foreclosed by entry of his plea. The district court held, quote, petitioner's valid plea forecloses federal habeas review of alleged constitutional errors preceding the entry of the plea, including claims asserted in the petition that do not attack the voluntariness of his plea. The court therefore concluded that Mr. Goggins' ineffective assistance of counsel claims, because they preceded the entry of his plea, they present no basis for federal habeas relief. That holding, which was the basis upon which the court denied his petition without an evidentiary hearing, directly contravened this court's binding precedent in Arvelo. Citing the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Hill v. Lockhart, this court in Arvelo held, quote, a defendant does not waive an ineffective assistance of counsel claim simply by entering a plea. Instead, because voluntariness of the plea depends on whether counsel's advice was within the range of reasonable competence demanded of attorneys in criminal cases, courts must continue to apply the familiar two-part test provided by Strickland v. Washington for ineffective assistance of counsel. So here, the district court's basis for denying Mr. Goggins' claim directly contravened binding 11th Circuit precedent.
Turning to your question, counsel, about that last point, if we're applying the Strickland test under Hill versus Lockhart, the second part of that inquiry is, would the filing of the motion have caused Mr. Goggins to forego his plea and to go to trial, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in Hill versus Lockhart, in fact, that second prong was dispositive because the Supreme Court found that the petitioner in that case had not actually pled with respect to the count at issue, that in fact he would have gone to trial, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And at least with respect to the entrapment count, in this case, the ground 3, one of the two that's at issue here, I've read it 100 times that there is actually no plea in that ground to that effect, correct?
I don't know that I understand the question, Your Honor, about a plea.
Well, he never, I guess my question is, with respect to the motion to suppress, I probably agree with you that he does say, had the motion been presented, he wouldn't have pled guilty and would have gone to trial. But he says something like, it prejudiced his right to go to trial. But he doesn't say anything of the sort with respect to the entrapment motion, right?
So turning to Mr. Goggins' 2254 petition, the entire premise of his entrapment claim, and I'm turning to his count 3 here, ineffective assistance counsel litigating an entrapment defense for unwillfully deviating from approved community control schedule, I would suggest to the court the entire premise of this claim is that his attorney failed to abide by the duty to which reasonable attorneys have to follow in criminal cases. Therefore, Mr. Goggins was not advised of the availability of an entrapment defense. And had there been a valid entrapment defense such that counsel was to the point that counsel was ineffective for failing to recommend it, I think that it's a reasonable inference from this petition, both of the state court as well as in the federal court, that induced Mr. Goggins to plead guilty, or at the very least, it interfered with the voluntariness of his plea.
Isn't another way to say that, Mr. Morley, that the entire premise of saying my lawyer failed to raise a defense is that you would raise that defense at trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me ask you about the state's harmless error argument. I think at least arguably Arvelo could be read to support this approach. The panel in Arvelo held that the state post-conviction court had unreasonably applied Hill, the district court made the same mistake, and that the district court's other three merit-based reasons for why the state court's decision withstood deference were erroneous. Could it be argued that if the last of these three weren't true, if the district court had correctly concluded that the ineffective assistance claims alternatively failed on the merits, then any error in misapplying Hill would have been harmless?
So once you set aside the erroneous reasoning that a guilty plea preclude you from raising an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, I would suggest we then fall back on this court's general standard for when a petitioner is entitled to a hearing in a 2254 case, particularly with regard to ineffective assistance. And in Hernandez versus United States, this court held that a petitioner is entitled to a hearing if he alleges facts that, if true, would entitle him to relief. And conversely, a hearing is unnecessary if either his allegations are patently frivolous, if they're based on unsupported generalizations, or if they are affirmatively contradicted by the record.
Counsel. So relating to that, and with respect specifically just to the entrapment issue, I know that your brief talks about that you thought there was entrapment with respect to the probation violation, but would you agree that there's no entrapment, that there's really no entrapment defense with respect to the personal identification charge?
Yes, Your Honor. The entrapment defense goes to the probation violation.
Okay, so in that case, to the extent that one could construe his 2254 petition as suggesting that was a grounds for reversing his guilty plea as far as the personal identification charge goes, you would agree that's not meritorious, that there's no reason to have an evidentiary hearing on that.
There would be no reason for a separate evidentiary hearing. The evidence would still be a hearing with regard to the other claim, but you're right, Your Honor, with regard to the possession of personal identification information, that doesn't go to the entrapment defense.
Thank you.
Could I ask you something about something you said earlier? You said that had he known that this was a viable defense, then he would have gone to trial. Doesn't it seem from the petition itself that he repeatedly says that he requested that his lawyer file these motions, and that for reasons having to do with, frankly, Mr. Goggins doesn't know, in fairness, the lawyer's negligence or the lawyer's forgetfulness or the lawyer's malfeasance, he says in one instance, the lawyer didn't file the motion that Mr. Goggins requested?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Goggins asked, the record shows Mr. Goggins asked his lawyer to file a suppression motion, which I would add is the same circumstances as in Arvelo. Mr. Goggins also asked his attorney to pursue an entrapment defense. But again, this is coming from the perspective of a layperson who doesn't necessarily know whether there is any merit here, right? These are part of, you know, general background culture, right? You hear about suppression motions, you know entrapment is a thing. You don't know if in a particular case you have valid claims. And so you rely on your attorney. You rely on your attorney's guidance. You rely on your attorney's decision making. And to the extent that your attorney fails to satisfy Sixth Amendment effective assistance of counsel standards, your constitutional rights are thereby violated, and the voluntariness of your plea is thereby vitiated.
Was that true in Arvelo too? I didn't read Arvelo as making clear that in that case, In other words, one big difference, it seems to me, between Arvelo in this case is that in our case, the petitioner knew about the defendants, the defenses, instructed his lawyer to file the motions, and the lawyer didn't. Subsequent to that, the petitioner then waived the filing of any defenses in the petition plea that's included as tab E in the appendix. But in Arvelo, it was never a motion or a defense that the petitioner had asked the lawyer to file. It was something the petitioner had never thought of and the lawyer never thought of. And that's what the court said was deficient performance. Isn't that a difference?
So at four separate places in this court's opinion, this court points to the attorney's failure to move to suppress, his omission of filing a suppression motion. It doesn't get into what, if any, conversation regarding that motion happened beforehand. I would suggest that to the extent counsel is directly acting in contravention of his client's requests, that to the extent that not only was the decision ineffective, but he's making an ineffective decision in the face of his client's requests, that would be an aggravating circumstance, that to the extent that that would be a factual difference from Arvelo, if it is, that would make the situation even worse than Arvelo. I see my time is expiring, so if the panel doesn't have further questions, I'll reserve for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morley. You've reserved 5 minutes, and we'll hear from Mr. Duffy.
Thank you. May it please the court. Thomas Duffy on behalf of the secretary and the Florida Attorney General's office. Judge Altman, you made an excellent point about Arvelo. Arvelo, we maintain that the decision below is not inconsistent with the principles set out in Arvelo. Specifically, Arvelo talked about the defendant's or the defense team's ability to make strategic choices. As you pointed out, Judge Altman, in Arvelo, the defendant was uninformed. In Hill versus Lockhart, the defendant was misinformed.
Counsel,
here,
but counsel, isn't there a factual question here? I mean, if it turns out that we don't expect defendants to know whether or not a motion to suppress will be successful on the merits, we expect that their counsel will be able to make a reasonable decision, could be strategic, as to whether or not to file a motion. But we don't expect that counsel will not file a motion that might have merit solely because counsel is too busy in other cases, counsel, you know, otherwise isn't capable of doing it, or whatever the case may be. And it seems to me that if he pled guilty because counsel advised him to plead guilty because, you know, counsel was too busy to file these motions, as opposed to because counsel made a decision that strategically this was a better way to go, then there's still a problem. And we should have an evidentiary hearing to figure out what happened there. Why isn't that the case?
Because there is a substantial factual basis that Mr. Goggins was completely informed of this. He, for one thing, he knew that his lawyer had not had time to research the case. He signed a document, swore an oath on that document that he knew he was entering this plea fully in the knowledge that his lawyer hadn't investigated. He knew the strength of the state's case. He knew the state's resolve to see him punished. He knew the fact that the sentences could be run consecutively. He knew that he was facing potentially 50 years if the state went forward with the other matters that they mentioned that they had in their investigation. And despite all, he knew of the motion to dismiss, and he knew of the motion to dismiss for entrapment, and he knew of that they're asked for a motion to suppress. The fact that he doesn't know the law, that is vitiated by the fact that he knew he was entering this plea, which was to his advantage, fully aware that his lawyer had not investigated the case. So based on that, we believe that this factual situation is distinguishable, and
Mr. Duffy, even if we were to agree with you on that, do you agree that the magistrate judge in his R&R that was adopted by the district court judge probably got the standard wrong, as Professor Morley just made clear about cutting off? I mean, he uses the language about cutting off from McMahon, but then he goes a little further and suggests that any acts preceding the plea couldn't be the subject of a later ineffective claim, which seems to contravene both Hill and this court's decision in Arvelo. Isn't that right?
Well, let me explain. I understand you've asked me a direct question. Let me explain. I think that you have to read the short shrift he gave, the magistrate gave to issues 2 and 3, in context with what he said in issue 1. He cited Tollett versus Henderson in both cases for the proposition that under certain circumstances, the circumstances beyond surrounding the plea, not the necessarily the fact of the plea itself. We have no quibble with the action if you say, well, he pled, so therefore he has nothing, because the cases make that completely clear. So it's not the fact of the plea here that makes this case inconsistent with Arvelo. It's the circumstances of the plea are, we maintain, consistent with the language in Arvelo on pages 1348 and 1349 of the opinion. The cases speak about voluntary and knowing, and I can't imagine a set of circumstances here where you have less, not where you could have more knowledge at that stage of the game. He knows his lawyer hasn't fully investigated the case, but he knows the strength of the state's case.
Well, what do you make of Professor Morley's position? You've got Arvelo says these defendants, they don't know the law, so they rely on their lawyers. Lawyers should have known to file this motion to suppress the confession. That's Arvelo. Our case, Mr. Professor Morley says, is even worse, because we've got a petitioner who says, I think I have this motion, please file it on my behalf, and he, for whatever reason, refuses or fails to do so. What do you make of that position?
What I make of it is that Mr. Goggins knew all that and entered the plea anyway. So it's actually not worse. It's way better from our perspective that he knew that this hadn't been done. He felt, if he felt he had a viable motion to suppress, he should have said, okay, I want to go forward on this motion to suppress. He knew his lawyer hadn't gotten time. The clock was ticking on this, as the emails that are mentioned in the discussion in claim 1 said. The state wanted a plea right now. They had him dead to rights on the violation of community control. They had him dead to rights on the possession. He had a credit card with a name of a woman who's a college professor in Fargo, North Dakota, in his pocket. So he's not got a very strong case for defense. The only defense he would have would be if he could knock out those things through the suppression and or the entrapment. And I agree that the entrapment is very weak, and I'll get to that momentarily. But he pled. I'm sorry, Judge.
Yeah, before you leave this topic, you're talking about what Mr. Goggins knew at the time, but let's talk about what counsel did. You argue in your brief that there's no allegation that counsel was unprepared to file the motions, and you say it's more likely that counsel was unwilling to do so. Setting aside whether that even matters, you don't have any evidence for your guess about counsel's motives, right? Because there was no evidentiary hearing. Isn't that a reason why we would want to send it back?
Well, let me say this about evidentiary hearings. Personally, in my position, I wish state courts would have evidentiary hearings on this, because it makes the issues much cleaner for us. If the judge finds that he believes the defendant, he rules for the defendant. If he finds he doesn't believe the defendant, he says he doesn't believe the defendant, and that's pretty much unassailable on appeal. So we wish that would happen, but that's not realistic. One of the troubling things about Arvelo to me is the presumption in here that all these cases need to be worked up, and they don't. And this is a case that does not, because of the fact that he was knew of these defenses. This isn't like Mr. Arvelo, Arvelo, however it's pronounced. He did not know of these defenses. Mr. Goggins did. And that's why you do not need an evidentiary hearing here. And if you were inclined to remand.
But I'm sorry, but just the mere fact that that Mr. Goggins knew that there might be some defenses, if he's being advised because the attorney doesn't feel like filing or is too busy in some other case, if he's being advised these don't have any merit, right? When they might have merit, and any competent attorney with the same information might have, would have filed a suppression motion because it stood a chance of being granted, then, I mean, isn't that something we have to have an evidentiary hearing on? Why does it matter that Mr. Goggins knew that there might be a suppression motion available to him if he was being misadvised about its viability, not because counsel had made an informed decision about the law and the facts, but instead because counsel decided that, you know, there wasn't time to file one because counsel had too many other obligations?
Well, two things. One, this case isn't about I've got misadvised and therefore I entered a plea in ignorance, or that my complaint is that I was misadvised about taking a plea. His claim is my lawyer should have filed a motion to suppress. The other thing is he knew about the motion to suppress. So, and he knew that that would be a defense. It's not like
counsel. So as I'm understanding you, you're saying there are two reasons why we shouldn't worry about it. The first reason is because he doesn't connect it to the plea. But I think that if we go back through the 2254, he does actually connect it to the plea. He basically says, I wouldn't have, if the motion had been granted, I wouldn't have pled guilty, which makes sense because there would have been no evidence had that happened. So I don't think we can rely on that. And the second thing you said is the question that I'm asking you. So I need you to maybe hash that out a bit for me. In other words, the fact that he knows that there's a motion that might be able to be filed, why is that in and of itself enough, assuming for purposes of this question, and only for purposes of this question, because we don't know because there's no record, that his attorney told him, we're not going to file a suppression motion because, you know, it's not going to succeed. But he did so only because he didn't have time to research it and he hadn't actually looked into it. And that if any other competent attorney looking at the complete facts, were reviewing it, they would have filed the motion. Why, assuming those facts, does the fact that he knew that there might be a motion to suppress defeat his claim here?
Well, that's a lot to unpack there in the question, but let me see if I can address it this way. He did apparently know, according to his pleadings, some detail about why the motion would succeed. So he wasn't completely ignorant. And again, you don't necessarily have to know why the attorney did something if the defendant was fully informed. That's what these cases Hill speaks to and what Arvelo speaks to, is whether the person had knowledge. And in this case, there was clear knowledge of the existence of the things, of the grounds to it. He's the one that said, I was pulled out of the car. He's the one that says all
counsel,
this.
But counsel, we don't charge individual defendants as opposed to, you know, on an ineffective assistance claim. We don't charge individual defendants with having legal knowledge. I mean, how, you know, that's the whole idea here. The idea is he goes to his counsel and he says, I think we should file a suppression motion. And if counsel tells him there's no grounds for a suppression motion, when in fact there are grounds, I mean, he's not the attorney. And that's why he is receiving counsel from this attorney who's representing him. So how can we, do you have some authority that says we can look to what, you know, his legal knowledge is, even assuming that that were in the record, which it, I didn't see it there?
Well, I'm not sure he needs legal knowledge. He has factual knowledge of the thing, of the circumstances. And that's what the suppression motion was going to turn on, was facts. So no, we don't know that. But in this case, he seems to have been, he's got a college education, or at least he said he had been to college. He's 34 years old. He seems to have some knowledge of the system. So I think you have to take individuals as you find them. I see my time is running out. We believe that this case would be harmless for the reasons we set out in our brief, and that the appellant has not shown that, has not met the Brecht standard for showing harmlessness. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Duffy. Professor Morley?
Thank you very much, Your Honors. I'll just make three quick points in rebuttal. The first is with regard to whether there was a connection between the ineffective assistance of counsel and Mr. Goggins' decision to plead guilty. On page 31 of the supplemental appendix, which is Mr. Goggins' 2254 petition, Mr. Goggins, writing as a pro se litigant with no legal training, writes, defense counsel's failure to file motions suppressing evidence from the illegal stop was in violation of defendant's Sixth Amendment rights and prejudice to defendant's decision to forego trial, and meritorious, providing all evidence, including the defendant's identity, was fruit from the poisonous tree. Read leniently as we would for a pro se litigant with no legal training, he's clearly saying, he is expressly saying that the Sixth Amendment violation prejudiced his decision to forego trial. He's expressly linking his decision to plead guilty to the attorney's failure to pursue of a Fourth Amendment motion. Secondly, with regard
to- Mr. Morley, if I could just ask you about that. Judge Rosenbaum's question for Mr. Duffy gets right to the crux of this case. Which is, he knew about the motion, he asked his lawyer to file it, his lawyer chose not to file it. That is the extent of the pleading on ground two, and that failure to file, for whatever reason, prejudiced his right to go to trial. He never alleges, or tell me if I'm wrong, he never alleges that the lawyer misadvised him that the lawyer was not filing the motion because the lawyer didn't believe the motion was viable or for any other reason. He simply says he told him about it and the lawyer didn't file it, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does that matter?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the question for ineffective assistance would be if there is a meritorious Fourth Amendment motion to be filed, and you know, I went through the facts and legal argument in the brief as to why this would have been meritorious. When a client says, please file my motion, what would an effective lawyer have done? What do the standards of constitutional reasonableness require counsel to do? If it is constitutionally unreasonable for a lawyer not only to fail to file a meritorious Fourth Amendment motion, but to refuse the client's express directive to file the motion, well, then at that point, the client has suffered ineffective assistance of counsel, his plea, that and which vitiates the voluntariness of his plea. If the client is telling the lawyer, please file my motion, time is dragging on, the lawyer refuses to. At one point in the record, Mr. Goggins says his attorney even advised him that the deadline for filing it had passed, that it was too late to file the motion, which I would suggest would further exacerbate the circumstances. Then in that case, the plea would be deemed invalid. With regard to the second point, with regard to Arvelo, nothing in that opinion gets into whether or not the client actually knew. Mr. Duffy said Arvelo didn't know, but in fact, the opinion is simply silent on that point. To the contrary, the court's holding in Arvelo is broad enough to encompass cases regardless of whether the client knew there was such a thing as the Fourth Amendment. This court says, quote, where a petitioner faults his lawyer for failing to pursue a motion to suppress prior to entering a plea, both the deficient performance and prejudice prongs of Strickland turn on the viability of the underlying motion. This court doesn't suggest it has anything to do with what, if any, preliminary conversations that occurred, what, if anything, was the extent of the client's knowledge. And finally,
so what's the limiting principle then? If you can just simply, for any plea, if there's any dispute that you can conjure with respect to any possible theoretical motion that could have been filed in the case before, after the plea, what's to prevent us from having district court judges have evidentiary hearings in every single state court plea that's ever happened?
I'd fall back on this court's standard in Hernandez. You don't have to hold an evidentiary hearing if the allegations are frivolous, if they're based on unsupported generalizations, maybe there was something somewhere that could have been suppressed, or if they're affirmatively contradicted by the record. Here we have extremely strong, in particular, a suppression claim. Again, supported by Supreme Court precedent. So this isn't a case of a client hypothetically speculating about maybe there was something that could have been done. So as a result, not only was the district court's refusal to hold a hearing flatly erroneous under Arvelo, but Mr. Goggins was entitled to a hearing under this court's more general standard in Hernandez. If this court has no further questions, I will rest there.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both. And Professor Morley, I know you were court appointed. We very much appreciate your taking this case and your representation in this matter.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both. Have a great day.